At the opposite end from the entrance, Theremin saw what seemed to be a model of the whole universe, fashioned apparently entirely of precious metals and gems. Immense suspended globes, which seemed to represent the six suns, hung from the ceiling by invisible wires. Each of them cast an eerie light, a golden beam from the largest of them, which must be Onos, and a dim red glow from the Dovim globe, and cold, hard blue-white from the Tanositha pair, and a gentler white light from Patru and Trey. A seventh globe, that must be Kalgash, moved slowly among them like a drifting balloon, its own colors changing as the shifting patterns of the sun's light played over its surface. As Theremin stood gaping in astonishment, a voice coming from nowhere in particular said,
"May we have your name?"
"I'm Theremin 762. I have an appointment with Mondior."
"Yes. Please enter the chamber on your immediate left, Theremin 762.
He saw no chamber on his immediate left, but then a segment of the mosaic-covered wall slid noiselessly open, revealing a small oval room, more an antechamber than a chamber. Green velvet hangings covered the walls, and a single bar of amber light provided illumination. He shrugged and stepped in. At once the door closed behind him, and he felt a distinct sensation of motion. This wasn't a room, it was a lift. Yes, he was rising, he was certain of it. Up and up and up he went in a very unhurried way. It took half an eternity before the lift chamber came to a halt and the door slid open once again. A black-robed figure was waiting for him.
"Would you come this way, please?"
A narrow hallway led a short distance into a kind of waiting room, where a large portrait of Mondior 71 occupied most of one entire wall. As Theremin entered, the portrait seemed to light up, coming strangely to life and glowing so that Mondior's dark, intense eyes looked straight at him, and the High Apostle's stern face took on a luminous inner radiance that made him seem almost beautiful in a fierce sort of way. Theremin met the portrait's gaze coolly enough, but even the tough-minded newspaper man found himself ever so slightly unnerved to think that very shortly he would be interviewing this very person. Mondior on radio or television was one thing, just some crazed preacher with an absurd message to peddle. But Mondior in the flesh, awesome, hypnotic, mysterious, if this portrait was any indication, might be something else again. Theremin warned himself to be on his guard. The black-robed monk said,
"If you'll step inside, please."
The wall just to the left of the portrait opened. An office became visible within, as sparsely decorated as a cell, nothing in it but a bare desk made of a single slab of polished stone and a low backless chair cut from a chunk of some unusual red-streaked gray wood placed in front of it. Behind the desk sat a man of obvious force and authority, wearing the black apostle's robe with red trim along the hood. He was very impressive, but he wasn't Mondior 71. Mondior, judging by his photographs and the way he seemed on television, had to be a man of 65 or 70, with a kind of intense masculine force about him. His hair was thick and wavy, black with broad streaks of white, and he had a full, fleshy face, a wide mouth, a strong nose, heavy jet-black eyebrows, dark, compelling eyes. But this one was young, surely not yet 40, and though he seemed powerful and highly masculine too, it was in an entirely different way. He was very thin, with a sharp, narrow face and tight, pursed lips. His hair curling down over his forehead under his hood was a strange brick-red color, and his eyes were a cold, unrelenting blue. No doubt this man was some high functionary in the organization, but Theremin's appointment was with Mondior. He had decided just this morning, after writing his story on the Apostle's latest fulmination, that he needed to know more about this mysterious cult. Everything they had ever said struck him as nonsense, of course, but it was beginning to seem like interesting nonsense, worth writing about in some detail. How better to learn more about them than to go straight to the top man? Assuming that was possible, that is. But to his surprise, they had told him when he called that he could have an audience with Mondior 71 that very day. It had seemed too easy. Now he began to realize that it had been too easy.
"I am Phalaman 66.
The sharp-faced man said in a light, flexible voice with none of Mondior's compelling thunder. Yet it was, Theremin suspected, the voice of someone who was accustomed to being obeyed.
"I am the public relations adjutant for the home district of our organization, It will be my pleasure to answer any questions you may have.
My appointment was with Mondior himself, Theremin said. Solomon 66's chilly eyes betrayed no sign of surprise.
You may think of me as the voice of Mondior.
I understood it was to be a personal audience.
It is. Anything said to me is shared with Mondior. Anything that comes from me is the word of Mondior. This should be understood.
And nevertheless, I was given assurances that I'd be allowed to talk with Mondior. I have no doubt that what you tell me would be authoritative, but it just isn't information that I'm looking for. I'd like to form some opinion of what sort of man Mondior is, what his views are on other things besides the prophesied destruction of the world, what he thinks about...
I can only repeat what I have already said,
Polyman declared, cutting in smoothly.
You may think of me as the voice of Mondior. His Serenity will not be able to see you in person today.
Then I would prefer to return on another day when His Serenity will be...
Permit me to inform you that Mondior does not make himself available for personal interviews. Not ever. Not ever. His Serenity's work is much too urgent, now that only a matter of months stands between us and the Time of Flame.
Polyman smiled suddenly, an unexpectedly warm and human smile, perhaps intended to take some of the sting out of the refusal and out of that melodramatic-sounding phrase, the Time of Flame. Almost gently, he said,
I would guess that there's been a misunderstanding, that you didn't realize that your appointment would be with a spokesman for Mondior rather than with the High Apostle himself. But that's the way it must be. If you don't wish to speak with me, well, I regret that you've wasted your trip today. But I'm the most useful source of information you're going to be able to find here, now or at any other time.
Again, the smile. It was the smile of a man who was coolly and unapologetically closing a door in Theremin's face. Oh, very well, Theremin said after a moment or two of consideration. I see I don't have much choice. I get you or I get nobody. All right, let's talk. How much time do I have?
As much as you need. Though this first meeting will have to be a fairly brief one. And also, a grin, a surprising one, almost mischievous. You must bear in mind that we have only 14 months altogether, and I've got a few other things to do during that time.
So I imagine. 14 months, you say, and then what?
You haven't read the Book of Revelations, then, I assume?
Not recently, actually.
Permit me, then.
Polyman produced a thin, red-bound volume from some crevice of his apparently empty desk and slid it toward Theremin.
This is for you. You'll find much nourishment in it, I hope. Meanwhile, I can summarize the theme that appears to be of the greatest interest to you. Very shortly, exactly 418 days from now, to be extremely precise, on the 19th of Theptah next, a great transformation will come over our comfortable, familiar world. The 6 suns will enter the cave of darkness and disappear. The stars will make themselves manifest to us, and all Kalgash will be set ablaze.
He made it sound very casual, as though he might be talking about the coming of a rainstorm tomorrow afternoon, or the expected blossoming of some rare plant next week in the municipal botanical garden. All Kalgash set ablaze. The 6 suns entering the cave of darkness. The stars. The stars? Theremin said aloud. And what in fact may they be?
They are the instruments of the gods.
Can you be more specific, do you think?
The nature of the stars will be made more than amply clear to us, said Solomon 66, in a matter of 418 days.
When the current year of godliness comes to its end, said Theremin, on Theptar 19th of next year. Solomon looked pleasantly surprised.
So you have been studying our teachings?
To some extent. I've listened to Mondior's recent speeches, at any rate. I know about the 2049-year cycle. And the event you call the Time of Flame. I suppose you can't provide me with any sort of advanced description of that, either.
You'll find something along those lines in the 5th chapter of the Book of Revelations. No, you needn't search for it now. I can quote it to you. From the stars there then reached down the heavenly flames that was the bearer of the will of the gods. And where the flames touched, the cities of Kalgash were consumed even to utter destruction. So that of man and the works of man, nothing whatever remained.
Theremin nodded.
A sudden, terrible cataclysm. Why?
The will of the gods. They have warned us against our wickedness, and have given us a span of years in which to redeem ourselves. That span is what we call the Year of Godliness, a year 2049 human years long, about which you already appear to know. The current Year of Godliness is nearly at its end.
And then we'll all be wiped out, you think?
Not all of us, but most will, and our civilization will be destroyed. Those few who survive will face the immense task of rebuilding. This is, as you seem already to be aware, a melancholy repetitive cycle in human events. What is soon due to occur will not be the first time that mankind has failed the test of the gods. We have been struck down more than once before, and now we are on the verge of being struck down yet again.
The curious thing, Theremin thought, was that Philemon didn't seem at all crazy. Except for his odd robe, he could have been any sort of youngish businessman sitting in his handsome office. A loan applications officer, for instance, or an investment banker. He was obviously intelligent. He spoke clearly and well in a crisp, direct tone. He neither ranted nor raved. But the things he was saying, in his crisp, direct way, were the wildest sort of nonsensical babble. The contrast between what Philemon said and the way he said it was hard to take. Now he sat quietly, looking relaxed, waiting for the newspaper man to ask the next question.
"I'll be frank," Theremin said after a little while. "Like many people, I have difficulty accepting something this big which is handed to me simply as a revelation. I need solid proofs. But you don't show us any. Take it on faith, you say. There's no tangible evidence to demonstrate. Of course, that's what you tell us. But we'd all better just believe what you're offering us because you heard all this from the gods, and you know the gods aren't lying to you. Can you show me why I should believe you, though? Faith alone isn't enough for people like me."
"Why do you think there is no evidence?"
Philemon asked.
"Is there? Other than the Book of Revelations itself? Circular evidence isn't evidence to me."
"We are a very ancient organization, you know."
10,000 years old, so the story goes."
A brief flickering smile crossed Philemon's thin lips.
"An arbitrary figure, perhaps exaggerated somewhat for popular effect. All that we claim among ourselves is that we go back to prehistoric times."
"So your group is at least 2,000 years old, then?"
"A little more than that, at the minimum. We can trace ourselves back to a time before the last cataclysm, so we are certainly more than 2,049 years old. Probably much more, but we have no proof of that. At least not proof of the sort which you'd be likely to accept. We think the apostles may go back several cycles of destruction, which is to say possibly as much as 6,000 years. All that really matters is that we are pre-cataclysmic in origin. We have been quietly active as an organization for more than 1 year of godliness, and so we are in possession of information giving highly specific details of the catastrophe that lies in store for us. We know what will happen, because we are aware of what has happened many times before."
"But you won't show anyone the information you claim to have. The evidence. The proofs."
"The Book of Revelations is what we offer the world."
Round and round and round. This was leading nowhere. Theremin began to feel restless. It was all a big bluff, obviously. All a cynical fake probably designed to pull in fat contributions from the gullible likes of Boddicker and Vivien, and other wealthy folk desperate to buy their way into escaping the threat of doom. Despite Philemon's obvious appearance of sincerity and intelligence, he had to be either a willing co-conspirator in this gigantic enterprise of fraudulent fantasy, or else merely one of Mondior's many dupes. "All right," the newspaper man said. "Let's assume for the time being that there will be some sort of worldwide catastrophe next year, of which your group has advanced detailed knowledge. What is it exactly that you want the rest of us to do? Go flocking into your chapels and beg the gods to have mercy on us?"
"It is much too late for that."
"There's no hope at all, then? Well, in that case, why are you bothering even to warn us?"
Philemon smiled again, without irony this time.
"For two reasons. One, yes, we do want people to come to our chapels. not so they can try to influence the gods, but so that they can listen to our teachings in so far as they concern matters of morality and everyday decency. We think we have a message that is of value to the world in those areas. But second, and more urgent, we want to convince people of the reality of what is coming, so that they will take measures to protect themselves against it. The worst of the catastrophe can be headed off. Steps can be taken to avert the complete destruction of our civilization. The flames are inevitable, yes. Human nature being what it is, the gods have spoken. The time of their vengeance is already on the way. But within the general madness and horror, there will be some who survive. I assure you that we apostles most definitely will. We will be here as we have been before, to lead humanity into the new cycle of rebirth. And we offer our hand, in love, in charity, to anyone else who would accept it, who will join with us in guarding themselves against the turmoil that is coming. Does that sound like madness to you, Theremin? Does that sound as though we're dangerous crackpots?
If only I could accept your basic assumption.
That the flames will come next year. You will. You will. What remains to be seen is whether you accept it long enough in advance to become one of the survivors, one of the guardians of our heritage, or discover only in the moment of destruction, in the moment of your own agony, that we were speaking the truth all along.
I wonder which it'll be, said Theremin.
Permit me to hope that you'll be on our side on the day that this year of godliness comes to its close,
Palamon said. Abruptly, he rose and offered Theremin his hand.
I have to go now. His Serenity the High Apostle expects me in a few minutes. But we'll have further conversations of that, I'm sure. A day's notice or less, perhaps. I'll try to make myself available to you. I look forward to speaking with you again. Odd as this may sound, I feel that you and I are destined to work very closely together. We have much in common, you know.
Do we?
In the matter of faith, no. In the matter of the desire to survive, and to help others to survive, yes, I think so. Very definitely. A time will come when you and I will seek each other out, I suspect, and join forces to fight against the darkness that is coming. I'm certain of it, in fact.
Sure, Theremin thought. I'd better go get fitted for my black robe right away. But there was no sense in offending Philemon with any sort of rudeness. This cult of apostles was growing, apparently, day by day. There was a big story here, and Philemon was probably the one he was going to have to depend on for most of it. Theremin slipped the copy of the Book of Revelations into his briefcase and stood up.
I'll call you in a few weeks, he said, after I've had a chance to peruse this with some care. There'll be other things I'll want to ask you then. And how far in advance do I need to call for an audience with Mondior 71?
Philemon couldn't be snared so simply.
As I've already explained, His Serenity's work from here until the time of flame is so critical that he'll be unable to make himself available for such things as personal interviews. I'm truly sorry. There's no way I can alter that.
Philemon put out his hand.
It's been a pleasure.
And for me, said Theremin.
Philemon laughed.
Has it really? To spend a half an hour talking with a madman, a crackpot, a fanatic, a cultist?
I don't remember using those words.
It wouldn't amaze me to be told that you'd thought them, though.
The apostle gave Theremin another of his curiously disarming smiles.
You'd be half right, anyway. I am a fanatic, and a cultist, I suppose, but not a madman, not a crackpot. I only wish I were. And you will, too.
He waved Theremin out. The monk who had guided him in was waiting outside the door to take him to the lift chamber. A strange half hour, the newspaper man thought, and not very fruitful, really. In some ways, he knew even less about the apostles than he had before he had come here. That they were cranks and superstition mongers was still obvious to Theremin. Plainly, they didn't have a shred of anything like real evidence that some gigantic cataclysm was in store for the world soon. Whether they were mere self-deluding fools, though, or outright frauds looking to line their own pockets, was something that he could not yet clearly decide. It was all pretty confusing. There was an element of fanaticism, of Puritanism about their movement that was not at all to his liking. And yet, this Follman, this spokesman of theirs, had seemed an unexpectedly attractive person. He was intelligent, articulate, even in his way rational. The fact that he appeared to have a sense of humor of sorts was a surprise, and a point in his favor. Theremin had never heard of a maniac who was capable of even the slightest self-mockery, or a fanatic either, unless it was all part of Follman's public relations act, unless Follman had been deliberately projecting the kind of persona that someone like Theremin would be likely to find appealing. Be careful, he told himself. Follman wants to use you. But that was all right. His position with the newspaper was an influential one. Everyone wanted to use him. Well, Theremin thought, we'll see who uses whom. His footsteps echoed sharply as he walked at a brisk pace through the immense entrance hall of the Apostles' headquarters and out into the brilliance of a three-sun afternoon. Back to the Chronicle office now, a couple of pious hours devoted to a close study of the Book of Revelations, and then it was time to begin thinking about tomorrow's column. 11. The summer rainy season was in full spate the afternoon Shirin 501 returned to Saro City. The plump psychologist stepped out of the plane into a stupendous downpour that had turned the airfield into something close to a lake. Gray torrents of rain rode almost horizontally on fierce gusts of wind. Gray. Gray. Everything gray. The suns had to be up there somewhere in all that murk. That faint glimmer in the west was probably Onos, and there were hints of the chilly light of Tano and Setha off the other way. But the cloud cover was so thick that the day was disagreeably dark. Uncomfortably dark for Shirin, who still, despite what he had told his hosts in Jonglor, was troubled by the after-effects of his 15-minute ride through the Tunnel of Mystery. He would have gone on a 10-day fast sooner than he'd admit it to Calaritan and Cubello and the rest of those people. But he had come perilously close to the danger point in there. For 3 or 4 days thereafter, Shirin had experienced a touch, only a touch, of the kind of claustrophobia that had sent so many citizens of Jonglor to the mental hospital. He would be in his hotel room, working on his report, when suddenly he would feel darkness closing in on him, and he would find it necessary to get up and go out on his terrace, or even to leave the building entirely for a long stroll in the hotel garden. Necessary? Well, maybe not, but preferable. Certainly preferable. And he always felt better for doing it. Or he would be asleep and the darkness would come to him then. Naturally, the godlight would be on in his room when he slept. He always slept with one on. He knew nobody who didn't. And since the tunnel ride, he had taken to using an auxiliary godlight, too, in case the battery of the first one should fail, though the indicator clearly said it had 6 months' power left. Even so, Shirin's sleeping mind would become convinced that his room had been plunged into the depths of lightlessness, utterly black, the true and complete darkness. And he would awaken, trembling, sweating, convinced he was in darkness, even though the friendly glow of the two godlights was right there on either side of him to tell him that he was not. So now, to step from his plane into this somber twilight landscape, well, he was glad to be home, but he would have preferred a sunnier arrival. He had to fight off mild distress, or perhaps not so mild, as he entered the plexiglass foul-weather passageway that led from his plane to the terminal. He wished they hadn't put the passageway up. Better not to be enclosed right now, Shirin thought, even if it did mean getting wet. Better to be out there under the open sky, under the comforting light, however faint just now, however hidden by clouds, of the friendly suns. But the queasiness passed. By the time he had claimed his baggage, the cheering reality of being back home again in Sorrow City had triumphed over the lingering effects of his brush with darkness. Lilith 221 was waiting for him outside the baggage pickup area with her car. That made him feel better, too. She was a slender, pleasant-looking woman in her late 40s, a fellow member of the psychology department, though her work was experimental, animals in mazes, no overlap at all with his. They had known each other 10 or 15 years. Shirin would probably have asked her to marry him long ago if he had been the marrying type. But he wasn't. Nor, for all the indication she had ever given him, was she. Still, the relationship they did have seemed to suit them both. "Of all the miserable days to pick for coming home,"
he said as he slipped in beside her and reached across to give her a quick friendly kiss. It's been like this for 3 days, and they say we're in for 3 more of it, until next Onos Day. We'll all be drowned by then, I suppose. You look as if you've lost some weight up there in Junglor, Shirin.
Have I? Oh, well, you know, northern food, not really to my taste.
He hadn't expected that it would be so apparent. A man of his girth ought to be able to drop 10 or 15 pounds without it being noticeable at all. But Lilith had always had sharp eyes, and perhaps he had dropped more than 10 or 15 pounds. Ever since the tunnel, he had simply pecked at his food. Him. It was hard for him to believe how little he had eaten. You look good, she said. Healthy. Vigorous.
Do I?
Not that I think you need to be skinny, not at this late date, but it can't hurt to take a little off. So you enjoyed yourself in Junglor?
Well, get to see the exposition?
But yes, fabulous. He couldn't muster much enthusiasm. My God, this rain, Lilith. It wasn't raining in Junglor?
Clear and dry all the time,
the way it was when I left Sarrow. Well, seasons change, Shirin. You can't hope to have the same weather for 6 months at a stretch, you know. With a different set of suns in the ascendant every day, we can't expect the patterns of climate to hold still very long.
I can't tell whether you sound more like a meteorologist or an astrologer, Shirin said.
Neither. I sound like a psychologist. Aren't you going to tell me anything about your trip, Shirin? He hesitated.
No, the exposition was very fine. I'm sorry you missed it. But most of the time I was hard at work. They've got a real mess on their hands up north, this tunnel of mystery thing.
Is it really true that people have been dying in it?
A few, but mainly they've been coming out traumatized, disoriented, claustrophobic. I spoke with some of the victims. They'll be months recovering. For some, it'll be permanent disability.
And even so, the tunnel stayed open for weeks. After the problems began,
no one seemed to care. Least of all the people who run the exposition. They were just interested in selling tickets, and the fairgoers were curious about darkness. Curious about darkness. Can you imagine that, Lilith? They lined up eagerly to put their minds in jeopardy. Of course, they were all convinced that nothing bad was going to happen to them. And nothing bad did to a lot of them, but not all. I took a ride in the tunnel myself.
You did? She said, sounding astonished. What was it like?
A nasty business. I'd pay a good deal not to have to do it again.
But obviously you came out all right.
Obviously, he said carefully. I might come out all right if I'd swallowed a half dozen live fish, too. But it's not something I'd be likely to want to repeat. I told them to shut their damn tunnel down. That was my professional opinion, and I think they're going to abide by it. We simply weren't designed to withstand that much darkness, Lilith. A minute, 2 minutes maybe, then we start to snap. It's an innate thing. I'm convinced of it. Millions of years of evolution shaping us to be what we are. Darkness is the most unnatural thing in the world. But the idea of selling it to people as entertainment, he shuddered. Well, I've had my trip to Junglor, and now I'm back. What's been going on at the university?
Nothing much, Lilith replied. The usual stupid little squabbles, the usual faculty meetings, lofty declarations of outrage over this and that burning social issue. You know. She fell silent for a moment, both hands clinging to the steering stick as she guided the car through deep pools of water that flooded the highway. There's apparently some sort of fuss over at the observatory, by the way. Your friend Binet-25 came around looking for you. He didn't tell me very much, but it seems they're having a big reevaluation of one of their key theories. Everybody's in an uproar. Old Aethor himself is leading the research. Can you imagine it? I thought his mind had ossified a century ago. Binet had some newspaper man with him. Someone who writes a popular column. Theremin, I think that was his name. Theremin 762. I didn't care for him much.
He's very well known. Something of a firebrand, I think. Though I'm not exactly sure what kind of causes he fulminates about, he and Binet spend a lot of time together.
Shirin made a mental note to call the young astronomer after he had unpacked. For close to a year now, Binet had been living with Shirin's sister's girl, Raista 717, and Shirin had struck up a close friendship with him, as close as was possible considering the difference of 20-odd years in their ages. Shirin had an amateur's interest in astronomy,
That was one of the bonds that drew them together. Aethor, back doing theoretical work. Imagine that. What could it all be about? Had some upstart published a paper attacking the law of universal gravitation? No, Sheeran thought, nobody would dare. And you? Sheeran asked. You haven't said a word about what you did all the time I was away. What do you think I did, Sheeran? Go power soaring in the mountains? Attend meetings of the Apostles of Flame? Take a course in political science? I read books. I taught my classes. I ran my experiments. I waited for you to come home. I planned the dinner I'd cook when you did come home. You're sure you weren't on a diet now? Of course not. He let his hand rest fondly on hers for a moment. I thought about you all the time, Lilith. I'm sure you did. And I can hardly wait for dinner time. Well, at least that much sounds plausible. The rain suddenly grew even more dense. A great swallowing mass of it struck the windshield, and it was all Lilith could do to keep the car on the road, though she managed it. They were going past the Pantheon, the magnificent cathedral of all the gods. It didn't seem quite so magnificent now, with rivers of rain sluicing down its brick facade. The sky darkened another degree or two in the worsening storm. Sheeran cringed away from the blackness outside and looked toward the brightly lit controls of the car's dashboard for comfort. He didn't want to be in the enclosed space of the car anymore. He wanted to be on the outside, in the open fields, storm or no storm. But that was crazy. He'd be soaked in an instant out there. He might even drown, the puddles were so deep. Think happy thoughts, he told himself. Think warm, bright thoughts. Think about sunshine, the golden sunshine of Onos, the warm light of Patru and Trey, even the chilly light of Sitha and Tano, the faint red light of Dovim. Think about this evening's dinner. Lilith has made a feast for you to welcome you back. She's such a good cook, Lilith is. He realized that he still wasn't hungry at all. Not on a miserable gray day like this. So dark. So dark. But Lilith was very sensitive about her cooking, especially when she cooked for him. He'd eat everything she put before him, he resolved, even if he had to force himself. A funny notion, he thought. He, Sheeran, the great gourmand, thinking about forcing himself to eat. Lilith glanced toward him at the sound of his laughter. What's so funny? But Aethor should be back doing research again, he said hastily. After having been content so long with being the Lord High Emperor of Astronomy and doing purely administrative stuff. I'll have to call Bine right away. What in the world can be going on over at the observatory?
12. This was Sephira 89's third day back at Sorrow University, and it hadn't stopped raining yet. Quite a refreshing contrast to the bone-dry desert environment of the Sajikan Peninsula. She hadn't seen rain in so long that she found herself wonderstruck at the whole idea that water could fall from the skies. In Sajikan, every drop of water was enormously precious. You calculated its use with the greatest precision and recycled whatever was recyclable. Now here it was pouring down out of the heavens as though from a gigantic reservoir that could never run dry. Sephira felt a powerful urge to strip her clothes off and sprint across the great green lawns of the campus, letting the rainfall flow down her body in an unending, delicious stream to wash her clean at last of the infernal desert dust. That was all they need to see. That cool, aloof, unromantic professor of archaeology, Sephira 89, running naked in the rain? It would be worth doing if only to enjoy the sight of their astounded faces peering out of every window of the university as she went flying past. Not very likely, though, Sephira thought. Not my style at all. And there was too much to do, really. She hadn't wasted any time getting down to work. Most of the artifacts she had excavated at the Beklamat site were following along by cargo ship and wouldn't be here for many weeks. But there were charts to arrange, sketches to finish, Balik's stratigraphic photographs to analyze, the soil samples to prepare for the radiography lab, a million and one things to do. And then, too, there were the Thambo tablets to discuss with Mudrin 505 of the Department of Paleography. The Thambo tablets, the find of finds, the premier discovery of the entire year and a half, or so she felt. Of course, it all depended on whether anyone could make any sense out of them. At any rate, she would waste no time getting Mudrin working on them. At the least, the tablets were fascinating things, But they might be much more than that. There was the possibility that they might revolutionize the entire study of the prehistoric world. That was why she hadn't entrusted them to the freight shippers, but had carried them back from Sajikan in her own hands. A knock at the door.
Safara? Safara, are you there?
Come on in, Balik.
The broad-shouldered stratigrapher was soaking wet.
This foul, abominable rain, he muttered, shaking himself off. You wouldn't believe how drenched I got just crossing the quad from Euland Library to here.
I love the rain, Safara said. I hope it never stops. After all those months baking out in the desert, the sand in your eyes all the time, the dust in your throat, the heat, the dryness. No, let it rain, Balik.
But I see you're keeping yourself indoors. It's a whole lot easier to appreciate rain when you're looking at it from a nice dry office. Playing with your tablets again, are you?
He indicated the six ragged, battered slabs of hard red clay that Safara had arranged atop her desk in two groups of three, the square ones in one row and the oblong ones below them. Aren't they beautiful? Safara said exultantly. I can't leave them alone. I keep staring at them as if they'll suddenly become intelligible if only I look at them long enough. Balik leaned forward and shook his head.
Chicken scratches, that's all it looks like to me.
Come on, I've already identified distinct word patterns, Safara said, and I'm no paleographer. Here, look, you see this group of six characters here? It repeats over here. And these three, with the wedges setting them off.
Has Mudrun seen them yet?
Not yet. I've asked him to stop by a little later.
You know that word has gotten out about what we've found, don't you? The success of Thombo town sites?
Safara looked at him in amazement. What? Who?
One of the students, Balik said. I don't know who it was. Valoran is my guess, though Eilis thinks it was Stan. I suppose it was unavoidable, don't you?
I warned them not to say anything to...
Yes, but they're kids, Safara. Only kids, 19 years old and on their first important dig, and the expedition stumbles on something utterly astounding. Seven previously unknown prehistoric cities, one on top of the next, going back the gods only know how many thousands of years.
Nine cities, Balik.
Seven, nine, it's colossal either way. And I think it's seven,
Balik smiled. I know you do. You're wrong. But who's been talking about it? In the department, I mean.
Hiligo and Brangin. I heard them this morning in the faculty lounge. They're extremely skeptical, I have to tell you. Passionately skeptical. Neither one of them thinks it's even remotely possible for there to be even one settlement older than Beklamat at that site, let alone nine or seven or however many there are.
They haven't seen the photographs. They haven't seen the charts. They haven't seen the tablets. They haven't seen anything. And already they have an opinion. Safara's eyes blazed with rage. What do they know? Have they ever so much as set foot on the Sajikan Peninsula? Have they ever been to Beklamat, even as tourists? And they dare to have an opinion on a dig that hasn't been published, that hasn't even been informally discussed within the department.
Safara,
I'd like to flay them both, and Valoran and Sten too. They knew they weren't supposed to shoot their mouths off. Where do those two come off breaking priority, even verbally? I'll show them. I'll get them both in here and find out which one of them's responsible for leaking the story to Hiligo and Brangin. And if that one thinks he's ever going to get a doctorate in this university, he or she, whichever one it was...
Please, Safara,
Balik said soothingly, you're getting all worked up over nothing. Nothing? My priority blown and...
Nobody's blown anything for you. It all remains just a rumor until you make your own preliminary statement. As for Valoran and Stan, we don't really know if either of them is the one that let the story get out. And if one of them did, well, remember that you were young once, too.
Yes, Safara said. Three geological epochs ago.
Don't be silly. You're younger than I am, and I'm hardly ancient, you know.
Safara nodded indifferently. She looked toward the window. Suddenly, the rain didn't seem so pleasing. Everything was dark outside. Disturbingly dark. Still, to hear that our findings are already controversial and not even published yet.
They have to be controversial, Safara. Everybody's wagons are going to be upset by what we've found in that hill. Not just in our department, but history, philosophy, even theology. They'll all be affected. And you can bet they'll fight to defend their established notions of the way civilization developed. Wouldn't you if somebody came along with a radical new idea that threatened everything you believe? Be realistic, Safara.
We've known from the start that there'd be a storm over this.
I suppose. I wasn't ready for it to begin so soon. I've hardly begun unpacking.
That's the real problem. You've plunged back into the thick of things so fast without taking any time to decompress. Look, I've got an idea. We're entitled to a little time off before we get back to full-time academic loads. Why don't you and I run away from the rain and take a little holiday together? Up to Jonglore, say, to see the exposition. I was talking to Sharon yesterday. He was just there, you know, and he says...
She stared at Bollock in disbelief.
What?
A holiday, I said. You and me.
You're making a pass at me, Bollock?
Oh, you could call it that, I suppose. But is that so incredible? We aren't exactly strangers. We've known each other since we were graduate students. We've just come back from a year and a half spent in the desert together.
Together? We were at the same dig, yes. You had your tent, I had mine. There's never been anything between us. And now, out of the blue... Bollock's stolid features showed dismay and annoyance.
It's not as though I asked you to marry me, Sephira. I just suggested a quick little trip to the Jonglore Exposition. 5 or 6 days. Some sunshine. A decent resort hotel instead of a tent pegged out in the middle of the desert. A few quiet dinners. Some good wine.
He turned his palms outward in a gesture of irritation.
You're making me feel like a silly schoolboy, Sephira.
You're acting like one, she said. Our relationship has always been purely professional, Bollock. Let's keep it that way, shall we?
He began to reply. Evidently thought better of it, clamped his lips tight shut. They looked at each other uncomfortably for a long moment. Sephira's head was pounding. All of this was unexpected and disagreeable. The news that the other members of the department were already taking positions on the Thombo finds, and Bollock's clumsy attempt at seducing her as well. Seducing? Well, at establishing some sort of romantic rapport with her anyway. How utterly astonished he looked at being rejected, too. She wondered if she had ever accidentally seemed to be leading him on in some way, to give him a hint of feelings that had never existed. No, no, she couldn't believe that she had. She had no interest in going to North Country resorts and sipping wine in romantically lit restaurants with Bollock or anyone else. She had her work. That was enough. For 20-odd years, ever since her teens, men had been offering themselves to her, telling her how beautiful, how wonderful, how fascinating she was. It was flattering, she supposed. Better that they think her beautiful and fascinating than ugly and boring. But she wasn't interested. Never had been. Didn't want to be. How tiresome of Bollock to have created this awkwardness between them now, when they still had all the labor of organizing the Becklemont material ahead of them. The two of them, working side by side. There was another knock at the door. She was immensely grateful for the interruption.
Who's there?
Modrin 505,
a quavering voice replied.
Come in, please.
I'll leave now, Bollock said.
No, he's here to see the tablets. They're your tablets as much as mine, aren't they?
Sephira, I'm sorry.
Forget it. Forget it.
Modrin came doddering in. He was a frail, desiccated-looking man in his late 70s, well past retirement age, but still retained as a member of the faculty in a non-teaching post so that he could continue his paleographic studies. His mild gray-green eyes, watery from a lifetime of poring over old, faded manuscripts, peered out from behind thick spectacles. Yet Sephira knew that their watery appearance was deceptive. Those were the sharpest eyes she had ever known, at least where ancient inscriptions were concerned.
So these are the famous tablets,
Modrin said.
You know, I've thought about nothing else since you told me.
But he made no immediate move to examine them.
Can you give me a little information about the context, the matrix?
Here's Bollock's master photo, Sephira said, handing him the huge, glossy enlargement. The hill of Thombo, the old midden heap south of Becklemont Major. When the sandstorm slid it open, this was the view we had. And then we ran our trench down here, and down to here next. We laid the whole thing open. Can you make out this dark line here?
Charcoal?
Modrin asked. Exactly. A fire line here. The whole town burned. Now, we skip down to here and we see a second batch of foundations and a second fire line. And if you look here, and here.
Modrin studied the photograph a long while.
What do you have here? 8 successive settlement sites?
7, Balak blurted. 9, I think, said Sephira curtly.